Cass Sunstein, you dedicate your new book on liberalism to anti-liberals everywhere. I guess that's a reference to Hayek, who dedicated his Road to Serfdom to socialists of all parties. But do you think you can convince anti-liberals of liberalism?
I think so.
How?
In every human heart beats an enthusiasm for freedom, an appreciation that the rule of law is a good thing, a sense that pluralism has virtues because we can learn from each other and allow our friends and acquaintances to go in directions that make their lives go well. So the appeal of liberalism is general rather than particular. And while some people who are unexcited about freedom or who think pluralism is dangerous might take a longer time to convince than others, hope springs eternal and life is law.
Wouldn't something analogous happen in the other side of the equation? Because I think that human nature is very close to being binary. It has its side in liking freedom, as in the very good, eloquent way that you express the dedication, but it also has its serfdom, about which Hayek mentioned. And so Hayek wrote, "If all truths are to retain their hold on men's minds, they must be restated in the language and concepts of successive generations." Is this your attempt to do that with this generation?
In a way, thank you for that. And you're clearly right that the appeal of liberalism isn't a simple matter. So George Orwell's 1984, which I had long thought was basically a novelistic justification of liberalism, it's much more complicated than that. So that Orwell gets the fact that every person has a magnetic attraction also for order and for something like Big Brother. I'm hopeful that my book both restates old truths in a way that maybe young, new people can find attractive, but also gives an account of liberalism in some ways that is particularly suited for today, and that doesn't purely say we need to go backwards and recover old wisdom. That's never quite right. There may be old wisdom that's essential to recover, but we can do better than they did back then. And there's an insistence on the part of the book that there's a place for social and economic rights. And that's something which I think liberals should embrace. Many don't, and I honor them. They're part of my team. There's a lot of thinking to be done about regulation and what it should look like. It would be shocking if Hayek had the last word or if John Stuart Mill had the last word. If you learned a lot. And the idea of a big tent for liberalism, I think that's essential and maybe hasn't been sufficiently appreciated. So there are people who are liberals who are enthusiastic about a regulatory and welfare state, and there are liberals who don't like an aggressive regulatory welfare state at all. There are also liberals. To see this as part of a group of people who are all committed to freedom, pluralism, and the rule of law is, I think, a major step forward, especially because anti-liberals who have problems with these things are on the ascendancy, both in practice, and in some ways they have, you know, a theoretical apparatus that we have to engage with.
Your tent of liberalism is very big. I mean, your definition is very broad, and you encompasses Hayek as well as Burke, for example. Isn't there a risk that in the end everyone is a liberal and no one is a liberal?
Well, yes, but Hitler wasn't a liberal. Putin isn't a liberal. Xi isn't a liberal. Orban isn't a liberal. There are in North America and Europe illiberal and anti-liberal and post-liberal forces that proudly use those names. The idea that robust system of freedom of speech is an excellent thing is something that the left and the right occasionally have big problems with. There is illiberalism on the left, a form of censoriousness. There is illiberalism on the left with respect to religion. There is illiberalism on the left with respect to free markets. There are a lot of exclusions that the big tent insists on. And if you think that a command and control economy is a great thing and that private property is something to be overcome, these are illiberal thoughts. And liberals own celebration of property rights, and that is a pretty big tent. You can believe in property rights and think social democracy of certain sorts is wonderful, or you can believe in property rights and despise social democracy of just those sorts. But to recognize one another as squabbling family members rather than as, you know, fundamentally opposed is, I think, a step forward for humanity's future. At least that's the.
You said that anti-liberals are on the rise. Why do you think that is? Or to put it more concretely, do you think that the main threat for liberalism comes from the outside or the inside?
The outside.
Or liberal societies, let's say. External threats like geopolitical rivals or...
It's a great question. So... of course, the fact that Russia and China, you know, and I've been to China and I love the people of China, and I believe I have some Russian ancestry, so I'm very pro-Russia and Russians, but the Russian leadership and Chinese leadership are, in important respects, serious threats to liberalism as a thing. That's completely fair. In Europe and North America, it's really, we're in the midst of something. And when you're in the midst of something, it's really hard to know what you're in the midst of. But we're in the midst of something which is more destructive of liberal ideals than what we've seen in the recent past, and more of a threat. Which is the greater, I guess I would say, self-consciously liberal societies are a greater threat than what's internal. But it's very important for Europe and the United States, I think, to embrace their own highest ideals. And you know, this is an abstraction, but if you think of people who are frightened, or of people who are silenced, or of people who are... diminished or humiliated, these are concrete things, and we need less of those things.
But can liberalism sustain itself? You write in the book that liberal societies may depend on things on which liberalism as such is silent.
Yeah. This is, I think, the most fundamental point, which I don't think the book grappled adequately with. Okay, so there's a view going back to Tocqueville, which is that liberalism depends on various things which it might itself endanger.
So like
family, norms, faith.
So traditions.
Traditions. So let's take, this is why Burke is a very complicated figure.
Yeah.
Burke, hence, as a liberal, is fairly disputed. But let's suppose that a liberal society that lacks traditions, norms, family commitments and faith is at risk. Now, you might say all four, you might say some are more important than others, and begin to disagree with that. But I think it's right to say that any society depends on things that liberalism doesn't supply. That's right. And liberals should own that and not feel embarrassed by that. Liberalism isn't everything. Liberalism is a set of commitments. So let's suppose you thought, I think wrongly, that liberalism is reducible to one thing, the rule of law. That's it, period. Mm-hmm. And in my view, that would be an inadequate account of what liberalism is. But the rule of law is a very important part of the picture. If you were a rule of law, let's say imperialist with respect to liberalism, and then you were confronted with the claim, the rule of law isn't everything. A society can have the rule of law and have a lot of horror in it. It might have, you know, economic distress, and it might have no cooperation. It's just got this. I think the rule of law imperialism should not. That's true. Mm-hmm. I'm not supplying those things. To say that liberalism doesn't supply those things, I think, is fair. To say that liberalism eats away at those things, this is the Tocquevillian critique, mm-hmm. is a sociological speculation which, let's phrase it softly, doesn't have empirical defense. Let's phrase it more aggressively. It's a fairy tale. It's a just-so story. It treats liberalism as Voldemort, as an agent in history who is taking traditions and swallowing them. You could tell a story. Liberalism believes in freedom and choice-making, and that's inconsistent with traditions. No, or more cautiously, probably not. Mm-hmm. Each of us, you know, has traditions that we probably live in accordance with. Did we choose all of them? Almost certainly not. Does liberalism punch them in the nose? No. Liberalism says, you get to have freedom of speech and freedom of religion. It doesn't say that if you have a family tradition, let's say, that is Catholic, you have to rethink it. You don't have to. And say, this is where I live. This is who I am. Mm-hmm. And liberals say, no, that's what you're right to.
Mm-hmm. So you think that the post-liberals, like Patrick Deneen, paint a false picture of liberalism, in fact.
Yeah, I wrote to Mike Deneen's work more than I do right now. I feel a little bit what Abraham Lincoln is said to have said, I don't like that man, I must get to know him better. And Deneen, I have nothing negative to say about at all personally, but I don't like his work very much. I must get to know it better. But what I'd say right now, not having gotten to know it better, is that it doesn't have an adequate account of what liberalism is. I'm not even sure I can describe liberalism according to Deneen. I think liberalism according to Deneen, I don't like very much. So I'm with him, but I don't recognize that as liberalism. Mm-hmm. And the sociological point about what liberalism does is it's I don't want to be unfair to him, but it sounds like some left of center stories about what capitalism does, or what markets do. And these are empirical claims that would need fine-grained empirical support rather than some grand narrative. So I do admire his moral commitments. And his, you know, clearly norms and traditions that are worthy of respect, he's very concerned to perpetuate and protect. And hooray for that. And liberals should take that seriously.
Mm-hmm. But what would be the core principle of liberalism as you define it?
Well, there's a holy trinity, which is freedom, pluralism, and the rule of law. we would also emphasize, I think, self-government and a freedom from fear or security. So security understood as protection against private and public depredations is essential to liberalism. It goes back to social contract theory. I think we've overlooked a bit its centrality, partly because in liberal societies, freedom from fear has been so respected, at least for most people, not for everyone. But if you are subject to public or private depredations, your person or your property, that's a horror tale. And liberals don't want that. So Orwell writes about the future. One of his villains says, is imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever. That's a great line. Liberals don't want boot stamping on human faces. And I fear that post-liberalism, at least as it's worked through today, I'm thinking of Professor Tanin in particular, it doesn't have the concern about boot stamping on faces foremost in the mind, and it should. Self-government is something liberals are committed to, and I think they need to be, but I'm not putting in the Holy Trinity because some liberals have been more emphatic about freedom of various sorts than about self-government. And I'd like to say that they are showing kind of proto-liberalism, but I'm aware that democracy and liberalism, there's a lot to say about that.
Mm-hmm.
Complicated subject.
Mm-hmm. You say that freedom of speech is probably the most important freedom there is. We had a case recently in Switzerland where a man went to prison for an allegedly transphobic social media post. In Germany, the police raided the house of a retiree for calling a minister an idiot. Do those cases trouble you?
Yes, I'd like to know more about them if I'm expressing, you know, a clear view.
Uh-huh.
If someone says that, you know, trans persons are sick in the head, or if someone says that a minister is an idiot or a moron, that should be protected in a system committed to freedom of expression. There's a line from the Supreme Court, my own Supreme Court, which is my favorite line ever from a judge, which is compulsory unification of opinion achieves only the unanimity of the graveyard. It's a good line. And you know, that the basic liberal idea that people are entitled to say things that are wrong, and that the conviction that someone else is wrong should be, have a degree of humility in it. So we all have our own views about ministers, about trans persons, and, you know, if you threaten to shoot somebody, that need not be protected, or to make a threat to someone, a true threat, as some legal systems call it, that needn't be protected. But to express a view, that in Switzerland, in France, and the United Kingdom and Canada, strong presumption it's protected.
Exactly. I happened to host a podcast on which I invited one of your colleagues, Harvey Silverglade. He was also a student from Harvard. I don't know if you happen to know him, but I had him in my podcast, and coincidentally the ethos of it, which made him attracted to it, is that the purpose of dialogue is to let ideas die instead of us. That's very in line exactly with the quote you were mentioning. And not non-coincidentally, he's going to be coming to Zurich in a couple months to give a speech on the need for Europe of a First Amendment. Do you think that's something necessary?
I'm attracted to the idea. I should say that for an American to speak of what Europe should do is a little arrogant. And American traditions come from Europe. We've added our own ingredients to the brew, but Europe is the foundation for what the United States and Canada are doing, of course. a First Amendment for Europe. There are free speech principles in European nations. Whether the First Amendment of the American kind is well suited to Switzerland or Norway, I'd be cautious about. Basic principles of freedom of expression, which are, I understand, embraced in European nations, should be embraced in European nations, and whether they should be fortified is a very fair question. My intuition is that if the question is ever should free speech rights be fortified, the answer is always yes. So let's see what the details are there.
States tend to go into a deficit, and the reason for it is I think that it creates an inflation. When you reduce your solvency, the debt of the state, which the currency is, has to devalue. And that devaluing of the currency, which is inflation, is a hidden tax to the population. Hayek, non-coincidentally, once said, I couldn't paraphrase the quote exactly, but something like, I don't think there should be, we will have a way of explicitly taking the money out of the hands of the government, but we will have to find a sneaky roundabout way. And that was around 60, 70 years, or I don't know how many decades ago, long before Bitcoin. But, and I'm not trying here to make any kind of sale of Bitcoin. I'm not endorsing anything. I'm just genuinely talking about the philosophy behind the movement of decentralization, and which is also seen in some cities like Prospera and Honduras, people who are trying to decentralize things. Do you think there's any potential for Bitcoin as an idea for taking the power out of the state and making the cost of the state more explicit and allowing free speech to stop being hindered and possibly defunding the war machine?
Okay, so I want to be careful not to go beyond my expertise. So the idea that the deficit is a clear and present danger, I would approach with caution. That the optimal level of inflation isn't zero, that what level of inflation is an assessment to be made that balances the cost of goods being more expensive with the benefits of potentially higher levels of employment, lower levels of unemployment, and goods available goods and services. A rocketing inflation is profoundly destructive to people's lives, and it's essential to make sure that inflation stays manageable, especially because the hidden tax is especially burdensome for people who don't have much money. It's as a kind of progressivity built into it. So there's the deficit question, where in my country, under President Biden, the inflation level spiked, and whatever the cause of that, I think there's reason to believe that the policy choices were not optimal in view of what happened to the inflation. For Bitcoin, I feel very cautious to celebrate or to lament that the risks of fraud and analogous harms to investors, etc., is something that needs to be managed. Whether to have Bitcoin or analogs accompanying official currencies, I think I'd want to study that long and hard before expressing a view.
You become famous for the book called Notch and the concept behind it. Where do you think your critics clearly misunderstand the idea rather than identify a real problem?
Thank you for phrasing it that way. The criticisms that I love least are the first, my least favorite is that nudges are manipulative. This I hear more than I wish I did. And the reason is that there are educative nudges, which would, for example, tell you if you want to get to Berlin, here's the route you should take. That's a nudge for a GPS device. It doesn't manipulate you. Or if you go to a store and it says, this product contains allergens, and here are the allergens. That's educating you. And if you're allergic to shrimp, as I am, that doesn't manipulate me. And if you're not allergic to shrimp, as I hope both of you are, that doesn't manipulate you either. If you buy a car in some countries, it'll tell you something about features of the car, like safety features or fuel economy. That I was involved in that when I was in the U.S. government. That doesn't manipulate you. If you're automatically enrolled in a savings plan with easy opt-out, you have a little bit of a discussion of whether that's manipulative, but so long as you're told, you're automatically told, here's how you opt out, send an email or push a button, that doesn't seem manipulative either. So I have a book on manipulation, which has two chapters on this, but that's one concern that I think is ill-placed. There's another objection, which is not just treat people as stupid, and it treats people as sheep to be herded. And it's not that people are stupid, it's that people are human. So we're not calculating machines. We don't have infinite cognitive resources. So we can't attend to everything. So if we're, in an employment relationship, there may be something involving our salary and wages and healthcare that we're not attentive to, and a nudge might get us to attend. Or it might be that people are on some medicine and they have a hard time keeping track of, have they taken it, or have they taken everything, have they taken the right time, and they get nudged to take the medicine at the right time. And my country, over 100,000 people die every year because they don't take the medicines they're supposed to. That's a number. That's 100,000 human beings who die because they don't take the medicines they're supposed to. And various actors are using nudges to help people to take the medicines. And that's not that the people who are supposed to take the medicines are impaired. It's maybe they have a hard job. And they have to be at work at 8. Maybe you're running a company. Maybe they also have a heart pop. Maybe they forget. Can I take it? And, they're amazing people. Or maybe they're people who are elderly and they do have some sort of impairment. And it's not treating them like infants. It's like they're human. So the idea that nudges are based on an insulting conception of our species, that's also not my favorite.
It seems to me like the claim that nudges are manipulative are an error of not distinguishing the level of analysis. It's analogous to going to the street and claiming that a policeman arresting you is authoritarian. This is not the moment we should be discussing that. It's not when you're in the street, in the grocery shop, seeing the different ways things are settled, that you should be criticizing that. It's at the level of the policy that you go there and talk with you while you were in the government and posing those questions. So that claim about nudges obviously are multifaceted, and there's a lot to talk about this. But in some way, some people have concerns about it leading to a reduction in liberalism. And I think that we are, in the liberal societies, very weak towards an attack that is hidden. So Trumpism has been enacting a lot of, or talking a lot about increasing freedom of speech. And that has, I think, been the thing that has allowed him to get into power, in the same way that wokeism has been talking a lot about the freedom of women and LGBT. If you cover yourself in liberalism, you can introduce any liberal idea into the system. How would you inoculate the liberal societies against this kind of attack?
Okay, so should we talk about nudges? Nudges are freedom-preserving interventions that also steer people. So you might think cigarettes we shouldn't ban, but we should have a warning. And we should have a warning that either is educative or that is a little more aggressive than educative in order to get people attentive to the health risks that are associated with smoking. But if it's a nudge, it's insistent that you get to decide whether you smoke. If you want to smoke, you're perfectly entitled to do that. And if you want to gain weight and eat unhealthy foods that are full of sugar, absolutely. But there will be interventions that equip you with the information you need or the architecture you need to avoid the health risks, if that's what you want to do. Now, there's a very, salient objection in my country, and it's coming to Europe, which is the nudges are terrible because they reduce the incentive for what's necessary, which is a more aggressive intervention. So this is the opposite of the direction you're going, and I'll talk about both. Noticing that the two different arguments are both being made. But the more salient one now is that nudges are a bad turn because what we need is much more aggressive steps to protect people against, you know, health risks, environmental risks, safety risks, and nudges eliminate the incentive to do what needs to be done. So they're kind of neoliberal corporate plot nudges. Now, the reason I don't accept this objection is I don't believe it has an empirical foundation. I've worked in the U.S. government for 8 of the last 13 years or so, and I work closely with European officials, I still do, on in the OECD and the World Bank on behavioral stuff. And I can't think of a single case where an aggressive regulation was not done because of a nudge. I can think of a lot of cases where people said we should nudge and not ban. So should we ban sunscreens that don't protect against cancer, but do protect against burning? There's some low-level sunscreens where it's not really going to protect you against cancer, but it will protect you, make your tan nicer and less. Should we ban that? The nudge idea is no, inform people. This doesn't protect you against cancer. It's going to have it's a suntan lotion. Or with respect to alcohol, should we nudge people in a way that will reduce drunk driving, or should we ban alcohol consumption? People aren't not banning alcohol consumption because there's a nudge. They aren't not banning cigarette smoking because there's a nudge. They decided on principle that the nudge approach is better. So there's that. Then there's another objection, which is there's a slippery slope. You do the nudge, and then it's going to go to the worst thing. I don't believe that there's any empirical foundation for that either. So I don't know that there's any. It's in principle possible, but that there's a case where people say we're going to nudge people to see the caloric content of their food, and then we're going to ban fudge and chocolate cake. Haven't seen that. So it is true that there are measures with respect to smoking that are more aggressive than nudges. There are cigarette taxes, and there are bans on public, you know, smoking public places. But the cigarette taxes and the bans on smoking public places did not come because there were educative nudges first. It's not like they got the educative nudges and they thought, oh, now let's go bigger. It's that they thought these are all good things to do, and they might be wrong. So the idea of the nudges, I think of nudges as more safeguard against the more aggressive approach. I would like to see them that way, but the idea that empirically they fed off the other bad things, that's not that easy to defend. And the idea that they slide from nudges to prison sentences, I don't know there's any reason to think that's true. If it were, then we should worry.
Would you agree on the framing I did about illiberal ideas being covered on a veneer of liberalism to be able to be introduced in the liberal mind? Because I think that's the only way you could really sell the idea.
That's a great question. And I'm pausing over your examples. So surely it's a theoretical possibility that someone could say, I believe in freedom, I'm Mr. Freedom, and or Ms. Freedom, and then here are the things we're going to do that are not that, and I have cover. And surely that's possible, and almost surely that's out.
Okay, to make it clear, I wasn't making explicit reference to the Nazis in that case.
I was more
making a separating the topic to Trumpism and wokeism, but that's a different.
No, this is very interesting. So let's take wokeism. You're right that wokeism has a program that has liberation at its foundation. I think people who are woke, either that's their word for themselves or outside of describe it that way, might not be that excited about liberalism. Certainly Hayek isn't like a hero to the woke people. I think Hayek should be a hero. So even if we have significant disagreements with him, I think he should be a hero to all of us. And I think this is clearer now maybe than it was 15 years ago. That's interesting. So why is that? I think it's that Hayek didn't speak as saliently to the left, to an ascendant left and right 15 years ago as now. But I think you're surely right that people can voice freedom-related themes, but also have things in their program that aren't so liberal. And it's true that on the American side, there are people who I think have rightly been insistent on freedom of speech and viewpoint neutrality and objected to American universities for not being sufficiently open to a wide range of ideas. That's a fair and important objection. Who have also been at times willing to restrict speech. And that's maybe they have a license to do that politically because freedom has been their watchword.
Mm. Your next book is on the separation of powers. Have you been inspired by recent events?
Not really. So I'll tell you, the inspiration was very personal. I was working on something on separation of powers, and it occurred to me, the separation of powers? No. It's six things. The legislature can't exercise executive authority. The legislature can't exercise judicial authority. Those are two different ideas. They have different foundations. One of the boundaries protected by those two, not the same. The executive can't exercise legislative authority. The executive can't exercise judicial authority. Now we have four things. They all have different justifications. The courts can't exercise legislative authority. The courts can't exercise executive authority. Now we have six things. And they each have different foundations. Which are the most fundamental? That's a fair question. There wouldn't be a timeless answer to that question. You can imagine a time when the courts can't exercise legislative authority is the most important. Or you can imagine a time when the legislature can't exercise executive vote. That's super important because you might have an energized legislature that wants to put people in jail.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a separate executive authority, it would be differently separate in a parliamentary system, but let's just suppose there's some separation. The enforcement authorities might say, are you kidding? We're not going to put these people in jail.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't current events. And I thought there are six separations, and I thought this must be a familiar idea, but I haven't found it anywhere. So it's rare that at least this person gets an idea that's large and maybe new, and that's an exciting day.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what got that whole going.
But which of the six things do you think is most threatened at the moment?
Well, in illiberal nations like, let's say, Russia, the executive has legislative authority and judicial authority. That's really dangerous.
What about the U.S.?
Well, probably I think all six are doing pretty well. Probably the executive authority has been increasingly strong, and that's under both Democratic and Republican presidents. That's had risks and has risks today.
Cass Sunstein, thank you very much for the conversation.
Thank you. Very pleasure.